Welcome to Kansas City Cannabis, where local roots and city pride thrive. Whether you're new or seasoned to cannabis, our expert bud tenders offer guidance and a welcoming atmosphere at our four KC locations. Experience genuine service and hometown heart. Visit kccannabis.org for more.
Our man Buster Olney from ESPN joins us as he does every week. Good morning, Buster. How are you?
What's going on? You're running. You got your hands on the steering wheel of the ship this morning.
Oh man, that's dangerous, isn't it? I'm a little delirious. It's been a wild week for me, Buster. So we'll see if I can keep this thing on the tracks. You know, on this whatever. Keep it on the course here, steering the show. We got a lot to talk about. Before we get into trade deadline stuff, Jake tells me you've got some more Shohei Ohtani stories for us, so just let me have it. What do you got?
Yeah, so I've been working on a piece that's going to be on ESPN.com in the next few days, collecting stories about Ohtani during those 2 days. Because, what you learn is that, yeah, he was the biggest star of those 2 days. You know, he was in the home run derby. He pitched an inning. He led off for the American League. He had all that responsibility. But then you hear the backstories about how he absolutely, embraced all the attention that he was getting, not only from the fans, but also from the other people in the clubhouse, from the other stars who were treating him like a star. Last week, I think I touched on this with you a little bit, but I got more details on it. During the course of the All-Star game, I was working in the American League dugout for ESPN Radio, and I watched this interesting exchange between Teoscar Hernandez of the Blue Jays and Ohtani, where Ohtani was walking through the dugout, and Teoscar pulled him to the side, and it looked like, on the face of it, sort of like he was asking him to do a selfie. But then you could see that there was some interaction there with whoever was on the other side of the phone. And I talked to Teoscar the other day, and he goes, oh, that's right. He said, I have brothers back in Dominican. Because of visa issues, because of COVID, they couldn't come over for the All-Stars game, and so I wanted them to share in the experiences. And part of the biggest part of the experience, of course, this year with the All-Star game was Ohtani. And so Ohtani got on the phone. He can't speak Spanish, and Teoscar can't speak Japanese, and yet Shohei was just so funny talking into the phone with his brothers. He's making goofy faces like you do when you're 10 years old with class pictures and enhancing that experience. Vladimir Guerrero Jr., his teammate, asking my colleague Marley Rivera shyly, look, I don't know Ohtani. Can you introduce me, please? And him doing that. Peyton Manning, the Hall of Fame quarterback, he went into the weight room an hour before the All-Star game, saw Ohtani, wanted to meet him. Through the interpreter, he and Ohtani, as Peyton Manning told me, they were, talking about mechanics, the mechanics of throwing a football versus the mechanics of throwing a baseball. Kevin Cash, the manager of the American League, told me a great story about walking into the clubhouse before the All-Star game. And you've heard the stories about all the baseballs they sign. 875 baseballs are laid out on tables. And Ohtani looks at it like, oh, my God, like this is a – and Kevin Cash could see it in his face, like he's worried if he has enough time to get this done. And so Kevin says to him, look, you got to pitch. The last thing in the world we want is for you to have sore hands, sore wrists. Just do the best you can and, sign as many as you can. He signed 50 dozen baseballs, 10 jerseys, and 4 bats. And a lot of those, of course, for his All-Star teammates. So he embraced everything and went through it with this incredible joy that I think really resonated with people, not only fans who saw it on television, but all of his peers who just revere him.
That reminds me of the scene we saw when all of a sudden the sticky substance was getting enforced, and we saw pitchers throwing fits on the field, taking their pants off, throwing gloves down on the ground, and then Shohei Ohtani was like smiling and super respectful to the umpire and just here's my glove and all that stuff. Is that's just Ohtani, I guess.
Absolutely. One of the heads of communications for the Angels told me about, at the end of the 2 days when they're on a plane, He walks to the back of the plane to find Ohtani because he just thinks what he's done in those 2 days is remarkable, and that how he's trying to serve everybody. You know, posing for selfies with Fernando Tatis Jr., posing for, you know, pictures with Nelson Cruz. Everybody wanted a picture of Ohtani, who was down on the field. You know, David Ortiz wanted to meet Ohtani. And so he walks up to Ohtani, who doesn't speak much English at all, and, you know, says to him in English, you know, thank you. And Ohtani looked at him and said, says to him in English, you're welcome. And he just had the biggest grin. He just embraced the whole thing, which is why, you know, Dave Roberts and Terry Francona, you know, Kevin Cash, you know, people have been around the game a long time, were just in awe of how he handled everything and how he really did understand that it was about baseball, about a celebration of baseball, and it didn't have to be about him, which is really cool because there are a lot of situations these days where you see players where it's about them. And you know, it's, in some respects, we saw that with Giannis the other day. It really did feel like, in Giannis's case, it was about basketball, it was about Milwaukee, and he didn't necessarily have to be the star of the show. But in part because he recognized that, he was the star of the show.
Yeah. That's true. I mean, gosh, you talk about two stars in their sport that just are so likable, it seems like, in the way they approach things, but their superhuman ability makes you, draws you to them. But it is fun to have stars that also, you know, have a little charisma to them and are engaging in that regard, because sometimes you have stars that are a little more reluctant to participate and they don't resonate as well. That's pretty cool. I look forward to reading that, Buster. Okay, another thing I know you've been spending a lot of time covering, you did on your podcast the other day as well. We got the trade deadline coming up, and you've been breaking down who the buyers and sellers are. We have Annie Rogers, who covers the Royals for KCRoyals.com and the MLB website. She was asked, are the Royals buyers or sellers? And she basically said, they're not sure because they're still trying to figure out, like, how far are they really away from being a contender? You told us a few weeks ago that you think the Royals could still turn around and be contenders next year, even though they're having just a terrible season. They have won two in a row, but a terrible season so far. Where do you come down on the Royals when it comes to buying and selling right now?
Yeah, and I think first and foremost, we know that, you know, in the way Dayton Moore thinks, he's going to think about team building, and he's going to think about what's best for the organization as we go forward, which always brings us back to Whit Merrifield and what do you do with him, and is there some contender that's going to step up and pay in a big way for him? Based on what I've heard, I don't get that sense at all, that, you know, among the teams that would buy, the New York Mets and others, they, to this point, they haven't given an indication that they're ready to be aggressive. And if that's the case, it makes the decision easy. And then let me, you know, in sort of a parallel universe, I think the Detroit Tigers, who the Royals face on Friday, they're having a similar debate. Like, they've been playing really well. They won 37 of their last 64 games. And they've got Jonathan Scope, who is a, you know, on a one-year contract. He's having a nice season. He's a rental. And so the Tigers have to ask themselves the question, you know what? Considering that we're probably not going to get a ton in return for him because he is under contract for only 1 year, is he more valuable keeping him in the organization or trading for assets? If you trade for assets, you know, you probably get like a B-minus type prospect. But if you keep him, then you ride out the wave of success they're having. You reset culture. You reset expectations. My gut instinct, you know, is that's more what Dayton's thinking. You know, that his feeling of, look, as we go forward and we reset expectations, if we finish strongly in the second half, that launches us into next year. And if we have people who can help us that we could theoretically trade, then maybe it's best if we keep them because we're not going to get a ton of return anyway. And we've talked about how, you know, some teams have really valuable assets. The Cubs are at the top of that list with, Jock Peterson, who was traded to the Braves, and Anthony Rizzo, and Craig Kimbrell, and Javier Baez, and Chris Bryant. The Royals really don't have those type of assets available, especially now with Duffy going down with an injury. You know, he might have been the guy in a soft market for starting pitching who, you know, might have been the most attractive piece.
Yeah, I mean, and that just, doesn't that figure the Danny Duffy situation? I mean, that's just the way it's gone for him so far in his career, and it's like he builds up his trade value, and he's hurt. I mean, and that's the case again. I want to go back to Witt for a second. He's not having a great year. It's even by his standards, he's not playing terribly or anything like that, but he's not having a great year. But it's like the story of his career is he just doesn't seem to get the respect that his production would warrant. And he had to languish in the minor leagues while other guys got chances. You know, then he gets to the big leagues and he never gets to play the position that he wants to play on a consistent basis because, you know, they because he can play other positions and they always think somebody else might be better or whatever. And even though he's produced at the big league level, what you're telling me, that's what it's been in the past. Well, from what we've been told is that nobody's really ever offered much for Witt. Why? Like, what is it that I would think that a guy that can play so many different positions that you know is going to play every day, and even when he's not having one of his best years, is going to produce at some level, would be really valuable to a team. Why doesn't he have that much value?
Well, I do wonder, and I, you know, without having run this past being a rival executives, I don't know empirically the answer to this, but my guess is that a lot of folks in other organizations look at that contract that he has, which is a very team-friendly contract, and feel like, boy, between his value on the field as a player and his value to the Royals because of that contract, they almost assume, like, we can't get there. Like, we couldn't possibly get there to offset, you know, his value, what that means to the Royals. Think of Salvador Perez early in his career when he had that, you know, crazy team-friendly contract. What was it, like 5 years and $7 million? You could have theoretically at that time, you know, called the Royals and offer a prospect or two, but you couldn't have offset the value of that deal to that organization. And so I wonder if that also has discouraged other teams from being aggressive. Like, now that contract is worth too much. You know, a player in a parallel situation right now is Ketel Marte of the Arizona Diamondbacks. Diamondbacks are terrible. It's a lost season. They should turn over, and they can have Ketel Marte as a possible asset to deal. But he has, at the end of his contract this year, he has two team options. And I want to say for like $7 million and $7 million for an all-star caliber player. Think about that. Two team options, which means there's basically no risk in that contract for the team, and he's not paid that highly. That means that, you know, it's really difficult for other teams to make a deal that would be attractive for the Diamondbacks to move him, which is why the Diamondbacks are telling other people, yeah, we're not trading him. I kind of wonder if it's a parallel situation for Witt.
So how active do you think this trade market will be here over these last couple weeks? Or last week,
I guess. It's a great question. Yeah, and it's a great question because, I mean, let's face it. We're 8 days away from the trade deadline. It's July 30th is this year's trade deadline. Next Friday, and we have barely had any movement. You know, Jock Peterson got traded to the Braves. Steven Vogt, you know, a backup catcher, got traded to the Braves. Two relievers going to the Blue Jays. Besides that, almost nothing. And you do have contenders, you know, the Mets, the Red Sox, who could definitely use upgrades. But it just hasn't happened so far. I do think there's a chance the last 48 hours could be crazy. I do think in the end, the Cubs are going to, you know, take advantage of Craig Kimbrell's value now, and he'll get moved maybe to the Houston Astros, maybe the Boston Red Sox. You know, Anthony Rizzo, I think, gets moved. You know, the Red Sox would be a good fit there, so maybe the Cubs and the Red Sox wind up making a twofer. But all of that, it might be a flurry of activity at the end. You know, Jeff Bassan, my colleague who does such a great job on trade stuff, he's talked to executives who believe that, you know, in the end it might turn out to be a complete dud. It certainly has been a dud up to this point. I think, you know, based on the general managers I spoke with yesterday, they're saying that the asking prices on these guys is off the charts. So, you know, Kyle Gibson's probably the best available starting pitcher, the Rangers right-hander. The feeling among other teams is now, you know, price way too high. The Cubs, to this point, haven't set prices on their guys yet. I think they're waiting for the National League East to get more competitive, and they're hoping that teams, you know, like the Phillies jump in. and goose the, you know, the competition in this. But to this point, a lot more talk than action, that's for sure.
We're visiting with Buster Olney. All right, Buster, you referenced the Detroit Tigers and the fact that they've been playing some pretty good baseball. To be perfectly honest, when I look at the central standings right now, Detroit is what we thought the Royals would be. We thought Detroit would be terrible and that the Royals would be representative. Not that the Royals would be in contention or anything, but if right now the Royals were five games under 500 and had won six in a row, I think we in Kansas City would be going, all right, this is good. This team's making, they're showing signs of progress. You know, some things are coming together. And at least to this point this year, that has not been the case for the Royals at all, but it has been for Detroit. Why are the Tigers playing so well right now, and why are they creeping up closer and closer to 500?
I do think the hiring of A.J. Hinch has had a tangible effect on that team. You know, I always thought of A.J. as being one of the best managers in baseball. You know, for me right now, the best manager is Alex Cora, but A.J.'s right there, and he's right in that conversation. And A.J.'s someone who, you know, Royals fans know from his days there. He has a great energy about him, and he's really smart at how to connect with players. I'll give you an example. You know, before he went to the Houston Astros, you know, we were talking about over the phone, and I mentioned to him that there had been a perception of AJ that he was too close to front office. And so he goes to Houston understanding that, and in his first talk with the team, I have to clean this up a little bit. He basically says in so many words, you know what? We are bad, you know, cuss word. Mm-hmm. Fill in the blank. And then all year that becomes the thing. And the players rally around that. And you know, it makes them feel closer to him. And they loved AJ. AJ did a great job managing the Astros. And so that energy, I think that intuition he has in connecting with players, that's all translating, and I think he's got them moving all in the same direction. You know, they've got young players, like the Royals have young players. I feel like they're getting better. You know, maybe some of the Tigers starting pitchers are further along than the Royals starting pitchers are, and that, you know, has a lot to do with it. But I think AJ deserves a lot of credit. You know, my question is going to be at the end of the year, when you look at the Manager of the Year candidates in the American League, you naturally have Tony La Russa. You know, the White Sox manager. White Sox are in first place. He returns for the first time in 10 years. You have Dusty Baker, who's the manager of the Astros, who replaced AJ in Houston. And you have Alex Cora and AJ Hinch, who were suspended all through 2020 because of their roles in the Astros sign stealing scandal. I'm really curious about what the writers do in terms of attaching demerits, as they do in the Hall of Fame voting for Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, to Alex Cora, to AJ Hinch, for their role, you know, their one-year suspensions, because at the absolute surface level, there's no doubt that AJ and Alex have done phenomenal jobs in getting the Tigers and the Red Sox, respectively, to reset.
Yeah, that is. Do you care? Like, will it affect your vote
no.
at all?
No, my feeling, and it was this way about the Hall of Fame voting. Look, as far as Major League Baseball and the Hall of Fame are concerned, Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens are members in good standing. Yes, they were named in the Mitchell Report, but they've been employed by teams. You know, they're on the ballot, unlike Pete Rose, who was banned for life and has never been on the Hall of Fame ballot. Bonds and Clemens are on the ballot. And so when I did vote for the Hall of Fame in the past, I would vote for Bonds and Clemens because I feel like that's a decision that Major League Baseball had. You know, it was their offense so egregious that it took them out of eligibility for that? The answer is no. In this case, you know, Alex Cora, AJ Hinch, they've served their time. They served their suspension. They're now employed by teams. As far as Major League Baseball, they're members in good standing. So me as a voter, I'd have no problem with that ethical quandary. I'd vote for them if I thought they were the most deserving. Right now, I would vote for Alex Cora for Manager of the Year. AJ would either be second or third. But I do wonder, because we've seen in the Hall of Fame voting, there are writers who basically say, nope, my opinion's more important on the demerits, and I'm not going to vote for Bonds or Clemens. And I suspect there'll be some voters who will say, I'm not voting for Cora, I'm not voting for Hinch.
Sanctimony. We love people getting on their high horse and applying their own ethical standards to things like that. I'll just tell you a brief story about A.J. Hinch from me that you said about his time in Kansas City. I don't know how many Royals fans really remember his time that well in Kansas City, because that was a rotten time for the Royals before Dayton Moore and those guys got here. And he was here when there was a bit of a circus going on. Tony Pena was managing the team, and Nafy Perez had refused to go into a game because he was mad that he had been benched late in the season. And the report came out, a fight had kind of almost broken out between the pitching coach of the team at the time and Nafy Perez in the little area behind the dugout, because Perez was like, if I'm not starting, I'm not coming in. They tried to put him in a game late, and he refused to come in the game. And it was all a nightmare. And A.J. Hinch was, I think, the backup catcher on the team at that time. But he was one of those guys. I remember him well, Buster, because I was in the clubhouse every day. And he was one of those guys. You know, when you're in a clubhouse every day, there's certain guys that you can go talk to that'll tell you what's going on and have opinions on things. And AJ, I was like, dude, what's going on here? I mean, am I crazy? Because I was relatively young at covering a major league team at that time. It's like, is this as nuts as I think it is, or is this how it is in clubhouses all the time? He goes, let's go talk. And we sat. We walked over to some seats in the stands, and he laid out all the things he thought were wrong with the organization at the time, and not in like a clubhouse cancer way. It was like in a way of, man, this guy's taking mental notes on everything he sees around him and what he thinks is right and what he thinks is wrong. And it's like, if I ever get the shot to do something like this, I won't allow this to happen. I'll tell you that much. And at that time, Buster, I realized, yeah, this guy, I don't know if he's going to be, I thought he was going to be like a front office guy, honestly, like a GM type guy, not a manager. But it's not a surprise to me at all to see that he's doing well in his next chapter, because he was like that as a player.
You know, you and I often, Nate, when we always, you know, compare things that we're talking about to being a parent. and we as parents, you know, we have these challenges with our kids, and you spend a lot of time thinking, okay, what's the best path? You know, how can I reach my kid? What's the strategy that I can connect with my kid to make a point? To help them through a situation. What are the best words? What are the best actions? I think AJ does that with all of his players, and he puts a lot of thought into it, where he comes up with a strategy. I think Alex Cora does it as well. I've seen that. Like, I went to an event in Puerto Rico where Rafi Devers, after his first taste of the big leagues, you know, the perception of Devers was he was too fat, he didn't move well, he probably couldn't play third base, And Alex wanted to sort of pump him up and to make him feel better about himself, because he knew that Rafi probably had some sense of the negativity around him. And so they're doing this event in Puerto Rico, and Alex had like four or five friends there who played in the big leagues, but he saved the last introduction for Rafi. And man, does he blow him up, like in front of all these, you know, there are 200 kids there. Yeah, and here's Rafael Devers. Well, let me tell you about him, and let me tell you about his work ethic. And this guy puts in, and by the end of that, you know, that 5-minute, 8-10-minute speech, Rafi's chest is puffed out, and he's feeling great about himself. I think Alex and AJ have a great understanding of how to make that happen, and that doesn't happen without putting some thought into it. Not just showing up and saying, hey, the players need to bend to my personality, to my rules. It's what's the best way to help this individual player go forward, much in the same way we do with our kids.
We're visiting with Buster Olney. You mentioned Tony La Russa. I mean, look, his team's tearing it up. The White Sox are running away with the Central. He's got the best team, but a lot of us wondered, is he going to be able to connect with young players that want to express themselves? And some of the issues that he had early in the season about those types of things, we wondered, like, is this guy going to be able to connect? How has he done it? What do you think of the job he's done?
And I give Tony a lot of credit, because at the beginning of spring training, he made it very clear, look, I'm here to learn from these guys. I've been out of the game for a time, and you know, I need to get on board with them. Clearly, I mean, and you and I have been around teams and seen situations where that relationship got so bad that it took down the whole team, and clearly that has not been the case. You know, Lance Lynn, Jose Abreu, you know, Tim Anderson, other guys have been playing so well, Yasmani Grandal, that it, you know, any of that hasn't been a factor at all. I do think that it has helped him that Tim Anderson and Jose Abreu, who I perceive to be really important leaders in that clubhouse, and I'm not around that team every day, but my perception is those guys have made sure in their conversations with teammates, look, let's make this work. You know, we're going to make this work. That's really important. I think Tim Anderson and Abreu are really good people, and they're perfect people for this situation. So if there is some, you know, low-level grumbling, like we saw with Yermín Mercedes early in the year, he swung at a 3-0 pitch and hit a home run, and La Russa was unhappy about it and criticized him publicly, I think there's been guys behind the scenes who are making sure that everything falls in place.
Buster, great stuff as always. We appreciate it. I'll be listening to your podcast, and we'll talk to you again next week.
All right, Nate. Have fun.
All right, that is Buster Olney, one of the best, one of my favorites, and another one of my favorites, Mike DeCourcy, coming up next right here on Sports Radio 810 WHB.